Hello, and welcome to the Virginia Voice. I'm Patty Campbell, today with the Writer's Voice. And today we are talking with Jill Titus, who is the author of Brown's Battleground, Students, Segregationists, and the Struggle for Justice in Prince Edward County, Virginia. Jill, thank you very much. I should, I guess, be saying Dr. Titus. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You've come to Richmond to read from your book at a banner lecture at the Historical Society, the Virginia Historical Society. Are you getting a lot of response to the book in Virginia?
I've been very gratified by the response, and I think a good bit of that comes from the fact that Virginia has done a lot of work in the last 10 years or so to explore the story of massive resistance. You know, Prince Edward comes on the tail of the tail end of Virginia's massive resistance. So residents, I think, have been grappling with what happened in places like Norfolk or Charlottesville or Warren County for the last 5-10 years. So now I think people are really ready to hear the story of Prince Edward County, which is a very different kind of story than the other local massive resistance stories. And I've been very gratified by the interest in the book and the interest in the story. And I think some of the credit for that also goes to the Moton Museum in Farmville. Now that there is a civil rights in education museum in the old Black High School in Farmville, they are doing so much work on getting the story of what happened in Prince Edward County out to all sorts of audiences, from school children to adults, and I think people are net more interested now.
Now, to remind our listeners about what did happen in Prince Edward County, basically the public school system was closed down in order not to integrate.
Yes, Prince Edward was, there were five communities involved in the original Brown v. Board of Education case in 1954. One of them was Prince Edward County, Virginia. There, a group of Black high school students in Prince Edward staged a strike at their very inferior high school in 1951. They originally wanted to sue for a new building. Their lawyers from the NAACP encouraged them to make it a desegregation suit. They agreed. The case went before the Supreme Court. You know, the ruling came down in May of 1954, and then nothing happened in Prince Edward for 5 years until the district court laid down an order saying all Prince Edward County schools needed to begin making adjustments to be ready to open on a desegregated basis in September of 1959. And Prince Edward authorities responded to that ultimatum by saying, well, fine, then we're just not going to operate public schools at all. They abolished the public school system. They channeled public funds into setting up a private school system for white students, and they made no provisions at all, really, for the African-American children of the county.
Now, you're writing about history that's a very real and present memory for many people in the state. You're not from Virginia, though. How did you get interested in this story?
I got interested in this story because, first of all, I'd always been very interested in the history of the civil rights movement, and secondly, I was interested in the work of the American Friends Service Committee, which was a Quaker organization in Philadelphia that was very involved in peace and justice issues. They still are. They're still in the forefront of the global justice movement. But in the 50s and 60s, they were very involved with racial justice in the United States. And they had a five-year project in Prince Edward County. They had someone on, you know, sort of on the ground the whole way through this struggle, serving as a friend, as a colleague, as a sort of technical advisor to local civil rights leaders. And I was very interested in their approach to civil rights, and in their belief that as Christians we need to be involved in the campaign to achieve justice in our own country. And so I came at the story because I was interested in the American Friends Service Committee, and also because I have a background with the National Park Service, and I had run across the story of Moton High School, which is a National Historic Landmark, one of the most significant historic sites in the United States, through my work with the National Historic Landmarks Program. So it brought those two interests together.
Can you share a little bit of the book with us? Will you read for us?
I'd be happy to. I thought perhaps I would share a little bit of the introduction, which sets up the Prince Edward story. Moton High, 1951. The fiddler came to Farmville in 1951, demanding payment for generations of neglect. The largest community in rural Prince Edward County, located at the northern tip of Virginia's Black Belt, Farmville was a segregated town. Privileged white men controlled the banks, the businesses, and the schools, as their fathers had before them. Raised in a world defined by the principle of separate and unequal, they reserved the best jobs and schools for whites, congratulating themselves for their generosity in laying aside the leftovers for blacks. Jim Crow set the parameters in life in Prince Edward County, and until 1951, it was a quiet life. But everything changed one April morning. The young people rebelled, overthrowing the community's old model of race relations and setting in motion a chain of events that thrust Prince Edward into the national spotlight. On April 23, 1951, the student body at Robert R. Moton High School, the county's only black high school, went on strike, demanding an expanded curriculum, an end to overcrowding, and increased local commitment to black education. The students immediately sent a letter to the state's NAACP team, asking for legal assistance in their fight for a new school. Oliver Hill and Spotswood Robinson, the pillars of the Richmond NAACP office, were the force behind a massive statewide litigation campaign against the inequalities of Jim Crow. Under their leadership, the Richmond office was a beehive of activity, at one time simultaneously pursuing actions in 75 different school districts. The two were initially dismissive of the Moton action, but they agreed to make a brief trip to Farmville, fully intending to encourage the students to return to school. By 1951, the Virginia NAACP team, like its counterparts in other states, was no longer interested in filing suits to equalize segregated facilities. Lawyers instead sought an opportunity to argue that segregation itself was inherently unequal and thus illegal under the U.S. Constitution. Oliver Hill and Spotswood Robinson stood poised to challenge the entire premise of separate but equal in elementary and secondary education, but they didn't see Prince Edward as the ideal place to launch this effort. Local whites had a reputation for intransigence, and the lawyers considered black leadership in the county lacking in the combativeness necessary to sustain a lawsuit. They were on the lookout, instead, for a test case from a community with comparatively deep resource base and a strong history of organized civil rights activism. Thus already convinced that there was no less promising place in all of Virginia to wage the fight for equal schools, Hill and Robinson nonetheless stopped off in Prince Edward on the morning of April 25th. To their surprise, they found the strikers unwavering in their determination and their parents resolved to support the children's actions. Deeply impressed by this unexpected militancy, Hill and Robinson agreed to use the Moton students as plaintiffs in Virginia's first suit against segregated education. 3 years later, Davis v. County School Board of Prince Edward County would become one of the five cases immortalized together as Brown v. Board of Education.
How long have you been working on this book?
I have been working on this book for 9 years.
The reason that I ask that is in Richmond, Spotswood Robinson and Oliver Hill, very well-known names.
Yes.
Did you have an opportunity to talk with either of them as part of your work?
I did not. I did not have an opportunity to talk with any of the legal team. Most of the people that I spoke with over the course of this project were either local Prince Edward residents or they were civil rights workers involved in other organizations who came into Prince Edward to help during the struggle.
When you decide to write a book like this, how do you get started? How do you find those people that you're going to talk to and get them to talk to you?
Getting people to talk with you is, it's a long process. First of all, you have to know who you should be asking. And to do that, you generally need to spend a lot of time in the archives. You need to spend a lot of time looking at what else has been written to see whose story is this, and particularly who is willing to share that story with researchers. But I think it's also about getting to the point that people are willing to trust you. And some of that comes, I think, simply through going back again and again and being there. I spent weeks in the American Friends Service Committee archives, and at the end of those weeks where I had chatted with the archivists every day, I said, could you tell me whether any of these six people are still living and if you have contact information for them? And at that point they said, sure, we have contact information for these four people. You should start with this person. So then I called that person, and when she agreed to talk with me, she, at the end of that conversation, said, you should talk with so-and-so, and here's his contact information. And when you can call someone and say, so-and-so gave me your information and suggested that you might be willing to talk with me, then you're more credible.
Did you find it as easy to talk with the white people involved in this story as with the African Americans, or did the white people involved in this story not want to talk?
That's a really good question. I spoke with a number of white people over the course of this project, but they tended to be people on the progressive side, people who were involved with one of the local civil rights organizations, people who had advocated for improvements in the public school system, people who had spoken out, and who, looking back, are proud of what they did and proud of the side that they took. The white people who, today are not as proud of the side that they were involved with are much more reticent and much less willing to talk. I did do some outreach. I wasn't able to find many people who were willing to speak with me. I was able to piece a good part of the story together through what had been written at the time and through a couple of interviews done in the late 20th century. But I think one thing I really would have loved to see happen with this book was to be able to sit down with three or four graduates of the Prince Edward Academy and talk with them in the same way that I talked with graduates of Moton High, looking back, saying, this is the way that this experience shaped my life.
Now, I made the assumption that African Americans readily talked with you. Was that a good assumption, or were these bad enough memories for some people that they just didn't want to talk about it?
There are definitely a lot of people who don't want to talk about it, but today, more people are comfortable sharing their stories than was the case 10 to 15 years ago.
You actually deal with the toll that was taken on the students who suddenly had no school to go to in your book. Would you read us a little bit from the book about that?
One of the most interesting things to me over the course of this research was piecing together some of the stories of children who left Prince Edward County during these years, who moved into other communities to pursue an education. Many people did this on an individual basis. Families moved. Parents sent children to live with friends or relatives who lived outside of Prince Edward County. There were also a couple of larger scale programs. The Virginia Teachers Association, the professional organization for black teachers in Virginia, placed about 100 students with teachers and their families across Virginia. A number of the older students attended a junior college in North Carolina. And then the American Friends Service Committee placed about 70 students over the course of the crisis in several communities across the North and the Midwest. And those experiences were very, very interesting. The American Friends Service Committee saw this as an opportunity to turn a tragedy into an opportunity for a small number of children. They never lost sight of the fact that the first goal was reopening the schools in Prince Edward County, and that whatever good might come out of the situation for 70 children could not outweigh the way that it had destroyed the lives of 1,700 other children. But that said, they wanted to give those 70 children the best experience they could, open up the world to them, put them in communities full of cultural opportunities, integrated living situations. You had poor black students living with middle-class African-American families where the mother might be a law student and the father might be president of the local NAACP, or you had children who lived with white families and realized, hey, you know, they're pretty similar to us, and we're not that different. So they're just very, very interesting experiences, but I thought I would read a little bit about the experiences of some of these children. As part of the southernmost community in the project, the Baltimore sponsoring committee found it particularly difficult to provide its five students an experience that differed significantly from what they had known in Prince Edward County. School desegregation was still a new phenomenon in Baltimore, and residential and social patterns were generally segregated. Despite the clear interracial inclinations of committee leaders, members struggled at first to decide whether a student could have a good interracial experience in Baltimore. Eventually deciding to explore the possibilities, they arranged for the majority of their charges to attend integrated schools and placed one student with a white host family. Nonetheless, the obvious racial bifurcation of society caused the majority of placement students to note that Baltimore was in many ways similar to home. The student placed with a white family had a stretching experience. "It was hard for me at first to adjust because I had to get used to staying with a white family," he told educational psychologist Robert Green a few years later. "Nothing like this had ever happened to me in Prince Edward County. The stares of some of his black classmates, who didn't know what to make of a black Baptist who lived with white Quakers, reinforced the strangeness of the experience. As the only African-American in an otherwise all-white neighborhood, he met with a variety of responses from his new neighbors. The younger children tended to be aloof at first, but they became friendly as they got to know him. After an awkward beginning, he and the girl next door eventually forged a friendship that defied traditional racial conventions. Many of the adults, however, never fully reconciled themselves to the presence of a black outsider in their midst. Though some families embraced him, often engaging his services as a babysitter, many neighborhood adults were old Southern people, and they didn't really like me very much, possibly because I was friends with a white girl, and I guess they just couldn't understand or accept this. No doubt some resented his host family's decision to cross the color line, but none made any overt threats or visibly interfered with his blossoming friendship with the neighbor's daughter. Perhaps knowledge of the temporary nature of the placement stayed the hand of some of the neighborhood's more devoted segregationists. Perhaps his host family was well-respected in the community. Or perhaps angry neighbors were simply concerned about maintaining the appearance of middle-class civility. Despite the veiled hostility of some of the neighbors, the young man adored his host family, who had a zest for travel and took a trip almost every weekend. He accompanied them to California and Kansas to visit relatives, to New York City, and to a variety of historic sites around Baltimore. A year later, on the eve of his high school graduation, he told Green that going away to school and staying with his family was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. He left Baltimore with a desire to go to India with the Peace Corps and work in agriculture and human relations. Their helping me made me see that it is good to help other people, too.
You've mentioned the American Friends Service Committee, and now you've read about this young man's experience being hosted by a Quaker family. I'm curious, are you a Quaker?
I'm not a Quaker. I've always been interested in Quaker history, but I'm not a Quaker myself, although I guess I could say I've subscribed to a lot of the same beliefs that many Quakers do.
How did you get interested in the American Friends Service Committee?
I knew that they were living some of the more controversial and radical principles of Christianity. In the 1950s, they were advocating against the use of nuclear weapons. They were advocating for racial justice. They were advocating for an end to segregation in housing. They were out on the forefront of the peace and justice movement, saying that to harm another person is to harm the peace of God in another person and in ourselves. And I find that tremendously courageous and tremendously moving. It's anybody who was willing to challenge the status quo on the basis of, if we're supposed to be a Christian nation, why don't we look like one, to me is someone that I want to know more about.
Well, certainly the whole story about what happened in Prince Edward County kind of encapsulates the kind of thing that you're talking about. Hearing the story, reading the book, it's a gut clincher. You get so angry or so upset just remembering this or being reminded of it. Was it, did you find yourself getting emotionally involved in this story?
Very, very much so, particularly with a couple of individuals whose lives I was really able to trace throughout the whole trajectory of the story. I became so identified with these people that I personally felt nothing like what they felt, but I felt furious, I felt sad, I felt betrayed. And it was very difficult to have to immerse myself in the rhetoric of the segregationists, to go into their personal papers and read what they really thought. On the surface, they tried very hard to speak constitutionally, to talk in a way that was racially dispassionate, to talk about constitutional principles at stake. But when you go and look at their own personal papers, it's just some of them, just full of racial invective. And to spend hours reading that kind of stuff and then come out of it, it's a painful experience because you can't forget those words. They linger in your mind, and you feel like you need to go take a long shower or something, but to get it out of your head.
Now, you're a trained historian. You have a PhD that you earned at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Did you simply rely on that training, or did you have other strategies for getting the emotion packed away so that you could write a dispassionate history?
That's a great question. I think I really did draw on what I was trained to do as a historian, which was to not put myself in the story, but to seek to understand the perspective of all of the different players, even the people who I just found their actions reprehensible. But it wasn't my role to condemn them. It was my role to try to understand what made them act the way they did, and then let the story take it from there. And the fact that they don't come off in a great light, I think, is more indicative of the fact that history has not vindicated their particular course of action than because I consciously, deliberately tried to make them that way, because I consciously tried not to. But I think at the same time, I also tried to remember how chaotic and complicated life is, and that we all make decisions that, looking back even from the space of maybe 3 months, we say, why did I do that? Or why did I think that was a good idea? Or why did I go along with that? And to remember that things were happening very quickly. People were not always well informed about what was going on. They didn't see the long-range implications of some of the choices that they made, and that many people, I think, truly tried to do what they thought was best for their children.
You have made the point that all of the motivations were not simply racial bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, yes. Prince Edward was a place where people had at least many of the more well-to-do members of the white community for quite some time. It had kind of a lukewarm attitude toward public education. Many of them sent their children to private prep schools anyway. They weren't very involved in the local public school system. And when the order to desegregate came, many people thought at the time that, well, maybe this is an opportunity for us to just get away from public education because it's expensive, and do we really need it? Most of the children in this community will probably grow up and be in the tobacco fields, or they'll be working in the factories. Why do they need a solid education? And I think many people really seized on that. They saw the opportunity to save some money, to channel funds that otherwise would have been used to support public education for all of the children of the community into a pay-as-you-go kind of school system where those who can afford it get an education and those who don't,
And when you have larger numbers of people who don't, you have a larger labor force, you have an unorganized labor force, you have theoretically people who are going to be willing to work for less and do as they're told.
So that lurking in the back of this story, there is also an economic motivation. And the story is about more than a racial conflict. It is about the importance of giving each individual American child a good public education and the impact that not doing that can have.
Yes. The repercussions for the community were enormous. Hundreds of the brightest children of this generation in Prince Edward County were forced to leave or were able to get out and never wanted to have anything to do with the community again. I mean, you want to talk about a brain drain. The bonds of trust that were destroyed between neighbors, between people who thought they had relatively decent relationships with each other, but who realized when push came to shove, you're not standing up for my children or my family. That the betrayal of that is enormous. The fact that a whole generation of children was forced to watch white playmates, in many cases, go off to school in September when they had no school to go to, just reinforcing this idea that, well, things haven't changed much since 1865, have they? If you're white, you go to school, and if you're black, you go out and work in the tobacco fields. Isn't this supposed to be the 20th century? The ramifications are enormous, and when you think about the amount of time that these children were out of school, 5 years is an enormous amount of time in a child's educational development. So many of the older children were never able to go back to school because by the time the schools reopened in 1964, they were working. Their families were dependent on their wages. They never had a chance to go back. Even some of the younger ones who did try to go back found it to be so difficult, so hard, so painful to be thrust into a classroom of children who were 5 years younger than they, where they're struggling to read a primer and were embarrassed, were ashamed, and said, I can't do this. They didn't go back. Enormous, very high illiteracy rates, children who grew up to be parents who couldn't help their own children with their homework. These handicaps, these scars are passed down from generation to generation. And I think the Prince Edward story for us today is this is what happens when we fool around with the public education system. This is what happens when we say that education can be privatized without being damaging to our children. I think it's an instructive story for us now.
Could you read just one more short selection from your book?
Sure. In 1963, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights justified a proposed study of the county on the grounds that the events in Prince Edward offered important lessons for the future. Almost 50 years later, in the midst of a mounting retreat from Brown v. Board and an intensifying national debate over the future of public education, these lessons are more important than ever. As revealed in the U.S. Supreme Court's 1973 decision in San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez, education is still not regarded as a fundamental constitutional right, leaving its status precarious in the face of new threats. Whether or not Prince Edward's white leaders deliberately seized on the Brown decision as an excuse to pursue a long-cherished goal of ending education for the masses by privatizing the school system, its actions created just such a situation. In the early years of the crisis, leaders pointed toward government-issued tuition grants and tax exemptions, scholarship fund campaigns, changes to the local tax structure, and fundraising drives as guarantees that schools need not be public in order to be accessible to all members of a community. Stressing private schools' ability to provide parents more control over their children's school environment, they convinced many parents that public schools would handicap their children. Yet when the tuition grants and tax exemptions collapsed, and the scholarship fund drives failed to raise the amount necessary to keep all students enrolled, the private school champions allowed hundreds of working-class children to fall through the cracks. After all, they had no legal obligation to provide schooling.
education shifted from a fundamental right to a privilege for those who could pay. In an era of increasing educational privatization, flush with similar rhetoric of choice and parental control, vouchers, and increasing debate over federal support for private academies, the trajectory of events in Prince Edward County offers a cautionary reminder that no substitute for a publicly funded, publicly operated school system has ever proven itself able to provide consistent quality education for all children. In Prince Edward, privately operated alternatives, such as placement programs, free schools, and grassroots schools, lack the administrative longevity, the sustainable funding, and the community connection necessary to prevent the unparalleled educational devastation suffered by members of the county's lost generation. Even a full-fledged private school system, built on community institutions and constructed primarily with volunteer labor, soon proved inadequate to the task set before it. Hundreds of white children joined their black counterparts in the tobacco fields, in low-paying service jobs, and in front of the television because the safeguards guaranteed to keep private education accessible crumbled. A change in the political wind, a court decision, a recession, an unsuccessful fund drive, a readjustment of the tax structure, or an outbreak of community apathy, and the protections collapsed. The Prince Edward tragedy powerfully demonstrates the fact that the handicaps created by educational deprivation do not end with those directly affected. They are handed down to children and grandchildren. More eloquently than any words, they demonstrate the cost of abandoning public education's central role in the preservation of American democracy. As Edward Morton once said, "It's like when you take somebody and brand them. You can hide the scar, but the scar will still be there." Rita Moseley phrased her assessment differently, but conveyed the same idea. "You have to live for the rest of your life," she noted sadly, "wondering who you could have been or what you could have done with your life."
Dr. Jill Titus, reading from her book, Brown's Battleground, Students, Segregationists, and the Struggle for Justice in Prince Edward County, Virginia. Jill, thank you very much for joining us in the Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.